Hello, hello, hello. Today's episode talks a lot about taking a break. Just checking out for a little bit. And as you're listening to this, I am desperately trying to check out. When this episode drops, I should be in Puerto Rico with Nick for his 50th birthday. And of course, I didn't totally check out because, you know, I am a worker bee and also a mom of three. So we will have the bonus baby with us. But I am desperately, desperately trying not to be online. And we're going to see how that works for me. Because we all need a break and we all deserve a break. I have been hustling for the Sicilian inheritance. Continue to buy it, though, folks. Continue to buy it for the past few months. And I just want to breathe for a little bit. And that's what we're going to dig into today with my guest, Amanda Montai. I want to start out by reading something that Amanda wrote. It's a guest essay in the New York Times called Mothers Want to Be Left Alone. When my first child was a few months old, a man shouted at me while I stood in the snow with my sleeping baby slung over my shoulder, partially covered by a worn blanket. As I waited impatiently for my husband to fetch our car, I must have looked disheveled there on the side of the road, trying to hold my baby up and keep her warm. "What kind of mother are you?" the man yelled out his car window. My arms went numb and hot. When I was pregnant, strangers touched my stomach and lectured me on my purchases at the grocery store, so I was familiar with public expressions of ownership over my maternal body. A mother's body apparently belonged to the vague patriarchal laws I couldn't always identify and therefore needed to be taught, many of which rested on the assumption that a lack of autonomy was simply a part of motherhood. I gotta tell you, these words resonated with me so much, so much, as did Amanda's entire book, Touched Out. I quote her so often. I tell my husband all the time that I am touched out, that my body is done. It's done. And I'm so excited to have Amanda on today to talk about motherhood, misogyny, consent, our bodies, and the massive expectation gap that exists before we become parents and afterwards. Hi.
Hi.
I love that you just asked me if I was burnt out.
Yes.
Because I am. I'm burnt out. I'm touched out. I'm out. I'm just out.
Oh,
I'm
done. Take me out.
Take me out.
Bench me.
Bench. Coach, bench me. Bend. I don't want to be in here.
I want to sit out of all the rounds.
All of the rounds. I'm going to sit out these next ones. Like, what would happen? What would happen if I just sat out?
It would feel great.
It would feel amazing.
You could relax and sit.
But would everything fall apart? That's always my question.
Right. Probably not. Probably someone would step in.
Maybe. The answer is a resounding maybe.
We'll be determined.
TBD. Well, I'm very, very excited to have you here today because I love your book. I give it to people all the time. I just think the idea was so brilliant and the way that you wrote it was so smart. And I want to start by asking you a little bit about the title.
Yeah.
Because I use it a lot. I now borrow it a lot. I'm like, I'm touched out. That's what I am. How did that come to you?
Oh, good question. How did it come to me? You know, and I'm so excited to be here too. You know, I love everything that you do. You know, I think that the title came, it was slow going. When I started the book, it was like, I wanted to write a book about motherhood, whatever that meant, right? Mm-hmm. And as I got deeper into it, I realized that it was really a book about how motherhood had affected my body. But then, you know, I noticed this term touched out, like circulating online. And as I write in the book, like at first I felt a lot of recognition in that because I did feel that. I was like, you know, working in an in-home daycare and I had, you know, my kids hanging on me. But it also felt like there was a lot going on in that little phrase that was not really being explored. So, you know, I think the book is trying to unpack sort of what is underneath, you know, because when we say we're touched out, even like, you know, burnout, right? It's the sort of like catch-all term, right? We're at capacity. We don't have anything left. You know, let me have a break.
Let me have a break. I just want a break. Yeah, exactly.
But I was curious, like, okay, so what is it that we need a break from? You know, because often it does feel, especially when you have little kids, that you need a break maybe from your kids, right? But I think, you know, obviously, as I write in the book, that it's a lot more complicated than that. And so that's what I am trying to dig into in the book.
Yeah, and you do it so well. I mean, and you did end up, you know, using so much of your personal experience in it. What was it like to write something that was so intensely personal?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I mean, I think now that the book has been out for a while and I'm sort of like in a different place as a parent, when I was writing it, I was finishing it during the pandemic and I just felt like this intense sense of urgency to make sense of my experiences. And, you know, my first book was a memoir with like a little indie press. So, you know, I've always written sort of personally to kind of figure out the world. Like I needed that. And I don't think I would have made sense of my experience of early motherhood if I couldn't do that.
Right.
But yeah, I think the writing process, because of what was happening around me in the world, especially toward the end of the book, was just super intense. Like it wasn't always great. It really felt like I was sort of exercising, not exercising, like working out, but exorcising.
Exorcising. Yes,
yeah, exactly. All of these sort of like demons of my girlhood and starting to name like, okay, here's why I'm having these sort of physical, visceral reactions. And I think it allowed me to like let go of quite a bit.
Well, yeah, that's one of the things I want to dig into a little bit. Like, before you became a parent, what did you assume it would be like?
Such a good question. I mean, how much time do we have?
All day. Let's just, you know, all day until people start asking me to feed them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, in all seriousness, I think that, you know, as I write a little bit in the book, like I thought that becoming a parent would sort of take away some of my like independence and freedom, but in these very, you know, sort of like manageable ways, like maybe I wouldn't be able to go on vacation as much, you know, like having a dog, right? Or I couldn't stay up late, or, you know, I'd have to like budget my money better. Which is strange because I had spent years like studying, you know, so-called women's work, and I knew sort of the history of how that labor was erased and devalued, but I didn't really get it until I was in it. And I mean, I think I didn't understand really how physical motherhood would be, which is also strange because I was a nanny before I had kids.
Right, of course. Yeah. Yeah. But it's different. It's different.
It is different. But, you know, like I would end those days as a nanny, like so sweaty and like covered in food and shit, you know, like just changing diapers and foods like flying everywhere.
Yeah.
But I think I thought I could do it differently. You know, I thought I could do it better or more feminist somehow.
Yeah.
And you know, sure, okay, naivete. But I think it really all comes back to this idea that we can kind of like solve what's hard about parenting on an individual level, right?
When really it would be nice if the world helped to solve it and make it easier for us.
Right. Yes.
Yes. So what are the things, that's what you assumed. And I think that so much of our anxiety and tension and stress and everything that is is very difficult about parenting does come from this expectation gap of going into it. So you, that's what you assumed. And then what kicked you in the fucking face?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that physicality of motherhood, I think the loneliness, the alienation that I felt, you know, I was like an academic, you know, when I became a mom. And I think I wanted a break from that sort of hustle-y, competitive, very masculine culture.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just felt totally alienated from who I was before and very much kind of like slotted into this experience of like a stock image of like what a mother should be. So the physicality of it, but also like just the lack of control that I then felt over my life in terms of like what I could do for work and how I could pay for childcare and, you know, was it worth going to work if then I had to spend all this money on childcare and I wasn't actually bringing any money home and all the guilt and, you know, so all the things kicked me in the face.
All of the things. All of the things. Yep. Yeah. I mean, it is, I think it is shocking what that it is all of the things that kick you in the face. It is not any one thing. It is so many things that I remember when I went to the doctor and they do what I, their, you know, postpartum depression checkup, which I just think is kind of bullshit because it's not nearly enough. And what they do is not nearly enough. And their checklist is strange and almost accusatory too. Because it's like, if you feel these things, something's wrong. And I'm like, doesn't everyone feel these things? I don't think it's just me. I swear to God. But there's no way to say it's everything. It's all of the things. The weight of all of the things is so much. It's too much.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think, you know, the other thing about the sort of like postpartum checks is, and something that surprised me was how long the so much feeling lasted, you know, and then how disorienting that was. Like, do I have postpartum depression? My child is two, you know.
My child is two. Yeah. Yeah. Is this still postpartum? What is?
Right. Right.
What is postpartum? Right. Exactly. Well, and you've said before that going into this, motherhood felt like a script written by men. And I think about that a lot. One of my favorite examples is when people start asking me about the terrible twos and I'm like, oh my God, four is so much fucking worse. Three and four are terrible.
Oh yeah.
I'm convinced that whoever coined the phrase terrible two was a man who didn't realize his child was three.
The three-nager. Yeah.
The three-nager. Much worse. They worked outside of the house and they never came home until the kid was like all clean and tucked into bed. And they were like,
when's the kid's birthday?
What is it? Yeah. It made no sense to me. Or also the terms morning sickness.
Right.
Did you only see your wife puke in the morning? So you coined morning sickness? Because it's all the time sickness, my friend.
All the time for months. Yeah.
For months and months on end. And so I want to hear a little bit about what inspired you to say that. What kinds of things about motherhood felt like a script created by men?
Yeah, yeah, right. Well, I mean, so I think we could get very sort of historical about this, like just looking at how the housewife has been constructed over time.
Yes.
And who constructed that image, who had power over those early images, you know, of mothers that we all sort of have internalized. And, you know, how in, you know, the transition from feudalism to capitalism, the idea of the woman as a sort of keeper of home, who, of course, by the way, was not working and therefore wouldn't be paid, right? And how she to be. And previously, you know, there were more communal ways of living and thinking about sort of maintaining, you know, not just common space, but, you know, reproduction, right? Mm-hmm. And the way that reproduction and production, like wage labor, was sort of divided there. But I think even today, you know, we can like think about how all this online content that we consume, you know, parenting experts and advice, it's not always written by men, you know, but when I say like that this is a script written by men, what I really mean is that like, yes, men hundreds of years ago, right, created this image. And today, you know, that culturally, that image is still very much with us. And I think that, you know, even women internalize it and reproduce it sometimes without even knowing it.
Yes.
And, you know, are reproducing these kind of images of motherhood and parenthood that privilege men and discipline women, you know, into certain ways of being or talking or acting or relating to children or just obsessing about, you know, being a good mom. Another thing that I think about a lot today is that, like, the way that we parent today, even when it's against the ideal, like the image of the, you know, saintly sacrificial mother, it's reactionary. So it's like we're trying to just do the opposite of the nostalgic or sentimental image of the mother. Like,
I think about this a lot with wine moms, with like the wine mom imagery on social media. It's like you either get one or the other. You have to be the sacrificial martyr, or you're a hot mess, mom. Look at me. I'm a disaster. And I say this all the time. I'm like, I think most of us are just somewhere in the middle.
Right. Right. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. I've written a little bit about the hot mess mom and the wine mom, because it is that. Exactly. It's this binary, right? It's like good mom, bad mom. And it's very hard to get out of that kind of binary thinking, which is also, you know, a patriarchal construct. But it's also just very hard to think outside of all these parenting, you know, scripts that we've inherited, and to try to think of like, how could we think about parenthood or womanhood or, you know, motherhood or just like living with children outside of all that?
Yeah.
It's not an easy task.
It's not an easy task, but we try. You try so well in the book. I try so well on this podcast. And yet I feel like we're shouting into the wind.
Right, right, right.
All right. We're going to take a quick break. And when we get back, I want to dive into a little bit more about women and mothers and desire. All right. And then we take a fake break, which makes it very easy for me to cut this episode.
Fake break.
And now we are back. And now we're going to talk about one of my favorite topics, which is desire and motherhood, and why for so long, I think, you know, a lot of people, and definitely pop culture and media, have been very uncomfortable with thinking about mothers as beings with bodies who desire things.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I mean, I think part of this has to do with the way that we view the role of wife and mother. Again, those like inherited scripts that we are still trying to unlearn or rethink. You know, just sex alone, you know, was once supposed to be only within marriage and only for making babies, right? It had this utilitarian value, especially for women who were not supposed to have any sexual pleasure. They were just supposed to have sex when their husbands wanted to and have the children. You know, and even like during the era of the witch trials, like women who were perceived to have any sort of deviant sexuality, right? Those were the women that were accused of witchcraft. They were having sex with the devil, right?
Of course they were. Yes. Yes. Absolutely.
Very
absolutely.
Busy. Getting
so much devil sex. So much devil sex.
So much.
And, oh, wow. I just, you know, I'm constantly thinking about fiction and how well fairy sex does on the fiction list. Mm. So I'm like, wow, has anyone actually had sex with the devil yet? Or should I just make devil sex a thing?
Oh my gosh. Novel? There was that show, and now I can't remember the name, but.
Oh, was it Lucifer?
It was with Alexandra Daddario, and she's like having sex with this demon. I will send it to you, and we can put it in the show notes.
Yeah, totally. We need to put it in the show notes, because I'm like, yes, devil sex. Absolutely.
And it was like kind of cool and empowering for her, but also kind of just reproducing that image.
Yeah,
exactly. Women having sex with the devil.
Exactly, exactly. Well, yeah, I mean, I feel like women have been shamed for, and especially mothers, shamed for having desire, right? Like, no. Like, once you become a mother, that part of you is supposed to be shut down.
Yes.
Yeah. And I do think that we're starting Starting to break through that just a little bit, but probably not enough.
I mean, I think it's like with so many issues today, like it feels that we are culturally in this really different place, but also not, you know? I mean, it's a very short history that we're talking about. Like, you know, it was only like with the sexual revolution and the, you know, invention of the pill that we really started to see sex as like this recreational thing that could be about personal enjoyment and fulfillment. And, you know, even how that played out for women in the sexual revolution is really complicated. And we still culturally, like you see this in pop psychology all the time, you know, talk about women who have low libido, you know, or quote unquote libido. Have sort of an issue with that word. But, you know, we talk about them in terms of sexual dysfunction, you know. And this, again, is like descended from a long history of seeing women who fell outside the norms of motherhood and marriage as dysfunctional, rather than just doing what they wanted to do.
Just doing what they want to do with their bodies, just doing, having bodily autonomy. Having bodily autonomy, which you write so well about in the book, in Touched Out. I had, much like you, I had never had such a loss of bodily autonomy as when I had my children. I mean, it was just a non-stop circus of my body being forced to do things. Whenever they were needed, right? Talk to me a little bit about your own experience, because I think we have a lot of new mothers or nearly mothers, pregnant women, people who want to one day be mothers. And I think it's so important to talk about what that is like to completely have your bodily autonomy taken away from you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it plays out in so many realms in motherhood, you know, from like childbirth to the, you know, cultural pressure to breastfeed, to for me, when I became a mom, you know, in like 2015, you know, the mid 2010s, attachment parenting, you know, is telling you you've got to like hold your baby and sleep with your baby and do all these things. And some of that, you know, I did find really fulfilling. Like, I think that, you know, the connection, especially now that I have with my kids, is it's, you know, it's like luscious. It's great, you know. But when I first became a parent, I didn't know really how to say no, you know.
Yes,
And
same, same.
yeah. And so, like, I mean, again, there was all this cultural pressure telling me that I shouldn't, you know, that I should wear my baby all the time. And then, you know, you do like the Mobi wrap, and it's like takes
Oh,
45
God.
minutes just to put it on. And then the baby's like screaming on your chest,
They
strapped to
hate
you.
it. They hate it. They really do. I was such a Mobi wrap failure.
It's
Massive
very
failure.
hard.
It's very hard. I watched so many shitty YouTube
Totally.
videos, and failed. I mean, like the baby almost fell out of that thing many, many times because I was a bad Mobi wrapper, but I was terrified because I read all of these things about attachment parenting that said they must be attached to you all of the time. They must feel your heartbeat all of the time, or they will grow up to be sociopaths. And I was like, I must do this. I must do this. And I mean, I do not have baby three attached to me ever at this point. She doesn't even go in the ergo, really. I mean, because she wants to be down and around ever since she was mobile. She's like, I want to be with those other kids. Get away from me. And I think she loves me more than the other ones do. I really do. I don't think it has anything to do with how much I held her as a
You're
teeny
like a
tiny
rare
baby.
commodity now, so she wants
Yes.
to love
Well, exactly. Exactly. I think it's why children are so nice to dads that are never around, because they're like, you are special. Mom is here all the time.
Anyway. Yeah, and I mean, you know, I made my husband wear the baby all the time, and you know, so it's like I tried, but we also still had, both of us had this idea that we had to be on the baby all the time. And that's, you know, the intensive parenting ideas that like you cannot walk away from your child at any age
No,
ever.
never leave them. Never, ever leave them.
And I just feel like over time, you know, my relationship with my children, yes, they've gotten older, right? Which does make parenting easier, in some respects. But the more that I sort of let go of that need, it was also kind of a need to control.
Yeah, right? Of course.
My relationship with the child, or control the child, right? So that my kids don't become sociopaths, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I think they're good, but the more that I let go of that and I learned to say no, you know, and have my own, you know, boundaries and acknowledge my own limitations, we just have a better relationship. And I think it models for them that they too can be humans with limitations.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It models for them that it's okay to say no. Right. Once in a while, that you do not need to cater to everyone else's needs all of the time. And I think that's a good lesson, especially for young women who are taught that being helpful is paramount in life. I really, really do. All right. I want to switch gears once again. We are going to take one more break. And when we get back, I want to talk about your latest New York Times piece about sexless marriages.
Under the Influence is brought to you by Honeylove, my favorite shapewear of all time. It really is. I can talk about Honeylove all day long because it's truly that excellent. Yes, the Honeylove bra is the one that I'm wearing in my author photos. Yep, just wearing a bra under a hot pink blazer because you know what? I've got some big Sicilian energy. I do. And Honeylove gives me that. It gives me this confidence to just strut around like a bold, brash goddess. Yeah, I know that sounds like hyperbole, but have you seen my other photos? They are freaking hot, my friends. They are. And as I start packing for the Sicilian Inheritance book tour, you know that I'm bringing my Honeylove shorts and my Honeylove bra because I'm going to tuck it all in where I want to be tucked. I have so many gross old bras in my drawers that I know it's time to throw them out. It's time to make space. And I am vowing to spring clean my underwear drawer. I am. I'm going to finally get rid of that Patagonia bra from 2012. If you too are going to spring clean your underwear drawer, why not grab yourself some Honeylove? You can get 20% off your entire order with our exclusive link, honeylove.com/influence. So to support our show, check them out at honeylove.com/influence. Treat yourself to Honeylove.
Okay, so because I also have a podcast about marriage called Committed, so many people sent me your latest piece in the New York Times about sexless marriages. And can a sexless marriage be a quote unquote good marriage and a happy marriage? And I will tell you, my friend group, my group text was very, very divided on this.
Let's hear it. What are they?
So, you know, I am friends with a lot of moms who are in the thick of it, right? I'm in the thick of it. I've got a 6, a 4, and a 1. And I've written about this and talked about this before. I totally like having sex with my husband. It's great when we do it. We don't have that much time to do it. Or space. I mean, I am not a night sex person. I'm just not, okay? Because I'm tired.
Right.
And I'm a bad faller asleeper. So I have to like get in bed and read a little bit. And if I have sex, then I'm all excited. I'm not asleep. I don't fall asleep after sex. So we don't do it at night. We are like morning or midday sex people. And we're definitely not doing it that much, but we're super happy. Like, I don't think we've ever been happier. We like each other more than we've ever liked each other. And I don't think it has any relation to our sex lives.
Right.
And then I had other friends who were like, no, if we do not have sex twice a week, then we are going to be very disconnected from one another. And, it was a great divide. This was the great divide in my group text this week.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you know, we never get to choose the headlines. So, and that's
never.
Right.
Never.
So the question, right, of, you know, can a sexless marriage be a happy one? You know, I think that the piece itself really does more than answer that question, right, in one definitive way, which was not You know, I didn't want to make a case for marriage. I didn't want to make a case against marriage. I didn't want to make a case for sex twice a week or not, you know, like never having sex. What I was really curious about is just, I mean, exactly what you're sharing, right? What does it look like out there right now? You know, what do women especially, but I did speak with many men, what do these heterosexual partnerships look like? And how are couples talking about sex in their marriage? Because, you know, even what you're describing, like having this really clear knowledge about what you both want and what you both need and when you desire and when you don't, and, you know, how having sex affects you. I heard a lot of that stuff from the people that I spoke with. But, you know, these are new conversations. Again, this is like a really short history, you know. Spousal rape was only criminalized nationwide in the 90s, you know. So it's like it's a new frontier to talk about, what do you want? What do I want? How do we meet in the middle?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I feel like my parents probably never had that conversation. They got married in 1979.
Right. Yeah. No, I heard that from a lot of the women that I spoke with. I mean, I know, you know, in my own family, there's all kinds of stories about that in terms of feeling that there is a sexual duty or a sexual obligation that especially, you know, the woman has to fulfill. And I was curious, like, how much of that still exists? And a lot of the people that I spoke to for the piece, you know, did express feeling that sense of obligation. And sometimes they would describe feeling like really happy with where they were, you know, even if they weren't having sex a lot, but then quickly pivot to like, but we really do, you know, need to get back to it. And sometimes that's because they miss their partner, you know, and they wanted to reconnect and they wanted to be having more sex. They wanted more pleasure in their lives. Yeah. Sometimes it was because they felt guilt, like, there's got to be something wrong here, you know, and it didn't really seem reflective of what they needed, like as individuals, so much as, again, this cultural pressure to fulfill this image of what a happy, healthy marriage is supposed to look like.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, I do think that there's an intense cultural pressure of what a good marriage looks like, of what a happy marriage looks like. And, you know, it is like this idea of like sex twice a week was kind of ingrained in me. That like, oh, like, you know, this is how you connect with your partner and make sure or there's also the narrative that to make sure your partner doesn't stray, right?
Yes, exactly.
And, which is such an unhealthy thing to feed to women. Like, he will leave you if you are not giving him this thing,
right?
Twice a week. It's like it makes sex like a chore instead of a choice,
right? Completely.
But yeah, I will say, I mean, my relationship with sex has obviously changed so much after having kids because I am touched out a lot of the time, and it's getting better. It's getting better and better. I mean, before we had the baby, the bonus baby, when B was three and much more self-sufficient, my sex drive was definitely increasing again because I did not have someone attached to me constantly. But the second that we had that baby and I was breastfeeding and carrying her, and I was touched out. And I think we do get to a place where we are not any longer.
Yep.
But then I also have just different thoughts about how I want my body to be enjoyed, and I don't want to not used, but how I want to use my body after having kids. I think I'm much more conscious of having a body in the world after having kids.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah, and I mean, I think that all the mothers that I spoke to, you know, they expressed similar, right? That like, though maybe their awareness of their body or the changing feelings that they had about their body were different and diverse, they all had to kind of renegotiate things and had a new relationship with sex. And, you know, for some of them, as I write in the piece, like that had to do with like pain, you know, they had childbirth trauma, you know, and they, you know, they couldn't orgasm the same way, right? And so they literally, you know, like you're saying, had to sort of figure out how they wanted their body to feel and not be used, but what brought them pleasure, right? And so I think it's important that we just like allow ourselves that space to, you know, maybe you need to take a break and figure out what brings you pleasure on your own without your partner. And that's okay too. Or maybe you don't. Maybe you want to do that with your partner, right? But asking these questions, in relationships, I think are important.
Totally important. And I don't think that there's enough space to ask those questions, or we're not told to ask those questions. We're told exactly. that if we're asking those questions, maybe something's wrong.
Right.
Instead of thinking, oh my gosh, as human beings, we are supposed to be evolving
right.
together right. and our bodies are changing. I mean, also as we get older, our sex drives are changing. But yeah, I don't think that we are trained at all to question things or to have good conversations about them. I mean, until I wrote about my own sex life, when I did that Cup of Joe piece about liking vanilla sex with my husband, and then trying to write spicy sex scenes in Sicilian Inheritance, my friends and I had never really talked about our sex lives that much. Like it wasn't a conversation. It was almost taboo in a way, because if we say that it's not everything we want it to be, is there something wrong with our marriage?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I heard a lot of that too. I was surprised to, hear how many people, don't talk to their friends about their sex lives. I mean, especially the men that I spoke with.
I can't imagine my husband ever talking about his sex life with anyone.
Right.
Ever.
Right. And and so they too, I expected going into the piece, to find a lot of like impatient men who just wanted to have more sex with their wives. But really, I found a lot of men who I really empathized with, who were also renegotiating masculinity and what they, want from a relationship and what they think, a marriage looks like, and who are not talking to their friends about these things. And so sometimes are kind of mixed up, but are still, wanting their partner to be totally into whatever sex they are having. And that's new, that's like new territory. And I think it's great.
And it's great. It is great. Yes, exactly. Exactly. And I think all of these conversations that we're having around motherhood are great too. I do feel like there is more space than ever, despite the fact that we're being shown more and more social media images than ever of perfect seeming mothers, perfect seeming lives, all of which is bullshit, by the way. But I do think that we're having more and more conversations about what motherhood is like and like the reality of what motherhood is like. That can only be a good thing.
Right. Yeah, completely. I think so too. And I think, yes, maybe young people, are thinking more carefully about whether or not they want to become parents. And I think that that's a great thing. I think that's a good thing. Not something that we should worry about.
No. I mean, I hate the articles that are so doom and gloom about the birth rate plummeting and people not wanting to have kids. And I'm like, oh, what if we were all just more thoughtful about whether or not this is something we actually wanted and right. not something that was prescribed to us by society? Like, wouldn't that make, everything better for humanity?
Right, right. I mean, it's the same with like sex and sexuality. Like, what if we all just take a pause, like take a beat.
Take a hot
think
minute.
About what we want.
Yep.
And then we could go from there.
And then we go from there. What if, what if, what if? I love it. Oh, I could talk to you all day, but alas, I have to feed children shortly. But thankfully not from my body any longer.
Yes.
Not from my body. That is finished forever. Very excited about that. But just going back to the sex thing again, I'll like never think about my boobs as sexual things ever again. Which is very interesting to me. I'm sure that some women get over it, but like for me, like it used to be an erogenous zone and now I'm just like, those are udders.
Right. Totally. I mean, and a lot of women that I spoke to like lost feeling in their nipples. Right. So there's a total like psychological transformation, but also like physically, it just feels different.
just feels different. They're just very utilitarian now is what they are. Oh, will you tell everyone where they can find you and all of your things?
Oh, yes. You can find me not on Twitter. You can find me on Instagram sometimes at @AMONTEI and most often at my Substack, which is Mad Woman. I think it is my name.substack.com.
I believe it is. I was just on it. But I love the name of it. I love Mad Woman. There is a canyon in Wyoming close to this ranch that I went to called Mad Woman Canyon.
Oh.
And also an accompanying liquor store. Oh, so every time that I see your Substack, I think of that wonderful canyon and liquor depot.
That is all that we have for today, friends. I don't know about you, but I do want to take a break. Take me out of the game, coach. Take me out. I am not ready to play anymore. But I do feel good. I love talking about these things, and I love Amanda. Her book, Touched Out, Motherhood, Misogyny, Consent, and Control, is wonderful. It makes a great baby shower gift, way better than a onesie. No one needs another onesie, my friends. There are so many onesies in this world. We are going to drown in a sea of onesies. Get this book. Also, get adult diapers. Baby shower gift. Touched Out, a package of adult diapers. It is my best advice. It is my only advice right now. Go have a great day. Do something nice for yourself. You deserve it.